You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and it is July 12th, 2023. Life is definitely a struggle, and because of that, I'm appealing to my listeners to assist me financially. And all the means that you find on Radio Albion, my own site, theorthodoxnationalist.wordpress.com. Many of you have already visited it and support me in one form or another, or Patreon for that matter. Financially, I took a huge tax hit and several other utility-related things, which I unfortunately can't get out of. But my problems are fairly relative compared to our friend Sven Longshanks, and I do have some good news. I received a letter from him addressed to both Grandpa Dan and myself, and he seems to be doing pretty well. The British prison system is not like the American. In fact, I was surprised to learn that his healthcare issues are being well taken care of. He even thanked the British healthcare system for being what it is. He has been moved to the prison in Park, I think it's P-A-R-C, just a few miles away from Swansea in southern Wales. Which seems to be it's not even organized like a prison. It's almost like, for the nonviolent offender, they even have a youth wing for ages 15 to 18. And it's dedicated to rehabilitation, so there's a lot of work, technical skills and everything else that they're learning there. I don't think the U.S. has something like this. Now, I'm just judging by the website. It could all be propaganda for all I know, but he hasn't made any enemies. He's deepening his spiritual life, his understanding of the Old Testament. This shock to his system may well, as you know, see the case in Solzhenitsyn, Stuss, so many others, may have a very salutary effect on his later development. We'll also have his new address, prisoner number, and all the rest of it. The prisoner number remains the same, so if you send something to him at the other prison, it will eventually get to him. Anyway, today I want to talk about, of course, something that I have to talk about, but I'm talking about it in a very different kind of a way. I want to talk about the ideological underpinnings of Russia's special military operation. We really can't talk about this enough, and Alexander Dugin, a few weeks ago, laid out as to why. And I want to quote from him and use some of his concepts, which, were mine many years ago. But because it's true, Eurasianists and nationalists all over the world are coming to the same conclusions. Many of you are aware that I was the very first to trumpet the significance of Nova Russia, or the Donetsk and Luhansk republics, Donbass, Eastern Ukraine, whatever you want to call it. The revolutionary movement that split from the dying Ukrainian state of after the revolution of 2014. I was the first to translate their Declaration of Independence and Basic Constitution and other documents that placed them squarely in the social nationalist camp. But the war, which ultimately is over Nova Russia, of these republics, you can't use, and how many times have I said this, you can't use the normal vocabulary of international relations. You can't talk really about the older concepts of national interests or energy or territory. Of course, it's all present there, but it's far deeper than that. And this is one of the reasons that these make-believe experts, these idiots in the West never seem to get anything right, even by accident. And all of their predictions never, ever, ever come true. partially it's because they're really talking about something very different from what is going on. They appear foolish. They're not even using the right terminology. One of Dugin's great contributions, not just to this issue, but many issues, is dividing up global affairs into new sets of categories, or at least newly utilized sets of categories. And he has six of them, and many of you are familiar with these. The geopolitical, of course, is the first one. The deadly confrontation between the regime, or the civilization of the sea, or the oligarchy, or the trading states, free trade, whatever it is, versus the land, or the national, the Roman, so to speak, the traditional, which is manifesting itself in Ukraine, but of course has global implications. And the second is similar, but it's the notion that, I don't like using the phrase Western civilization, because I think of Plato and, Thomas and Middle Ages. Liberal civilization, which has taken root amongst Western elites, let's put it that way. When he uses West, that's what he's referring to. He's not talking about Thomas Aquinas. But that Western liberalism and nominalism claims that its Darwinian foundation is the purpose of all civilization. And that's the yardstick by which progressive versus backward societies can be measured. And the third comes directly from that, and that is the contradiction between the, well-worn terms, unipolar and multipolar. Those are extremely general terms. Unipolar was both the Soviet and the American idea of a single global order based on an ideology. The multipolar world, except in the most general natural law terms, sees the world is made up of very different kinds of civilizations and national traditions, while of course never deviating from natural law. Because of their history and geography, they develop different traits. And that's what the multipolar world comes down to, and it allows them to flourish. Fourth, what Dugin calls the culmination of world history, that is to say, the most blatant and obvious confrontation between liberalism and the civilization of Rome. But also be noted that the end of history takes a very unstable and idiosyncratic liberal world in the West as its agent. It is in fundamental crisis. Five, political economy, but the political economy of what happens when an oligarchy is dying. The psychological, the neurotic fixations of a collapsing system that at the same time claims to be eternal and universal and beyond reproach. And of course, finally, number six, the concept of the end times. This is the eschatological idea of the end of days, which is also relevant to this. Many times have I spoken of the famous Eurasian distinction between sea powers and land power. Sea powers tend to be, of course, based on free trade, technologically oriented and liberal, involved in consumption and hence hedonism. Today, of course, its headquarters is in Washington, D.C., New York City especially. And the land power is based on the example of Rome, whether it be Old Rome, the New Rome, or the Third Rome. And this is one of the reasons why Russia is at the center of all of this. The Rome versus Carthage, or Rome versus Tyre as its capital, or the old Phoenician capital, I should say, that it's based on monarchy, the existence of an empire, a sacred tradition, what we call hierarchical verticality, based on ontology, even a sacred emperor, civilization of the spirit. There's a variation of this in the great Slavophile Homiakov, and over the last few years I've covered that too. These are very general terms, of course, and even within, as he mentions, within places like the United States, the leader of the sea power, especially in places like the Midwest and certain parts of the South, the land mentality exists. Since the U.S. really, its ideology is clear, But it has the scent everywhere. It's, as I've said a million times, the historical choice between oligarchy and monarchy, between the pirate state and the national state, the truly national state. The pirate states have values that are always changing. They'll kick them to the curb tomorrow if it suits them. Very much like the sea itself, of course. And of course, they're obsessed with the concept of progress, which eventually was given its most significant formulation in Charles Darwin, which is an economic doctrine. And in Charles Darwin's own notebooks, his own autobiography says comes from Malthus, comes from the economic situation in England at the time. You can't understand Darwin without understanding the Industrial Revolution and the British colonial system. What's significant now, and as this war manifests, you could even see it in the war in Georgia, the battle going on in Israel. There's examples of this everywhere. Saddam Hussein versus the U.S., the war in Syria, all based on this same distinction. But under the rule of globalization, despite the greater diversity of peoples, the distinction, the confrontation between the two civilizations, for lack of a better word, ideologies, philosophies, ontologies, is clearer than ever. Of course, Russia and Eurasia, which includes Central Asia, became the leadership of the land. Of course, London, Amsterdam, New York is the core of and its military arm is NATO, the sea power. That's why this is the first truly global war. World War I and World War II, they dealt with, you know, mostly Europe and East Asia. This is purely global, and governments and peoples, even individuals, have to make a choice as to where they stand. The last 500 years, this is how, and even before then, this is how, I'm speaking mostly about modern times, this has been the division. Will it be monarchy, nationalism, the land, agrarianism, or will it be the technologically obsessed sea people, the traders, the usurers? Is it spirit or is it money? Is it spirit or is it matter? I disagree with Alexander Dugin when he thinks that the USSR is very much a land power and Russian at its core. I reject this entirely. The Soviet Union is an aberration hoisted by foreigners onto a very, right, the most traditional country in Europe at the time. The USSR is excluded from Russia being a land power. But the Third Rome means it inherited the archetypal land power, which goes from Sparta to the old Rome itself, and now, of course, eventually to Russia. It is the eternal Rome, the Third Rome. Modern West is Babylon. Problem is, the collapse of the USSR, and I remember following this when I was just a young man, my first toe going into the pool of politics, and that's what it was, the collapse of the Soviet Union, but it gave the liberal West the sense that it is now invincible. Thalassocracy and Tulocracy. That's the sea and the land power, respectively, to use the Greek originals, thought themselves that this is their moment. But they did realize, and I said this in the mid-90s, that Russia is going to be the center of resistance to what we used to call the New World Order. I was saying this when people were predicting Russia's going to disappear. The sea powers knew free trade, globalized, whatever, there's a million words you can use. They realize, though, like all revolutionary regimes, they realize that their enemies can very quickly reconstitute themselves. As far as the West is concerned, Eastern Europe was the first to be brought into the Western orbit. The Baltic states were right along with them, and then they moved to the interior of the old Soviet Union, the post-Soviet states, places like Georgia and obviously Ukraine. surrounding the core of Russia with military bases who have, in their own charters, their own ideological foreign policy concepts, a liberal agenda. A lot of this has been going on as far as, you know, militaries favoring non-whites and transgender and all this other nonsense. But the civilization, the usurers, the seafarers, the liberals continued this war knowing full well that the land power can very easily rise again, and Russia would be the engine of that. And therefore, even in the 90s, Russia was the target of immense propaganda. And Russia itself, in the 90s, was flooded with a Jewish, what we call it, a Jewish Atlanticist, flooded the country, and were placed in the highest positions with a typical of the sea power, a figurehead president. It became a dependent country because it was ruled by an unpopular group of foreigners, like Ukraine or Kiev today, who could never be elected if their life depended on it. But that's how the postmodern Russian elite was formed. But as NATO began to expand, and the former Warsaw Pact, exploited by the same world order, others had rejected it. Eventually, of course, Belarus was an important component of that, and all who rejected it, Belarus is a great example, eventually restored their former power and are far better run than the U.S. is. Ultimately, because of this aggression from the West, the Eurasian camp of Russia and China, Belarus, Serbia, and all of Central Asia, maybe Armenia, and even the DPRK against the liberal Atlantic camp in that area, which would include Moldova, Georgia, parts of Ukraine, and I don't want to say Azerbaijan because they have altered their trajectory recently, as has Turkey. A manifestation of this beyond, you know, Chechnya, financed by the West, was the August 2008 war in Georgia. Color revolutions could be found everywhere, but there were two in Ukraine, 2004 and 2014, which then led to the secession of Crimea and the uprising in Donbas or Novorossiya in 2014. Plenty of territories and peoples did not want to be a part of the American alliance and have foreign companies centralize their own economies against them. Of course, they went to Moscow and to a lesser extent, China. The revolutions in Ukraine in 2004, then in 2014, directly led to the start of Russia's military operation in 2022. Thanks to Putin, as I've said 9 million times, Russia very quickly became strong enough to confront the regime. And certainly the system that they installed in Ukraine, which now has a popularity, I think, in the negative numbers. And this was to reverse the trend of liberal dominance. The sea powers are liberal by their very structure. That is to say, atomistic, individualistic, etc. And as Putin rose, as China became the world's largest economy, the aggression and the neurosis of the Western liberal world, the elites became more irrational. But it's not just Russia anymore. We all know what's been happening with Turkey and India. The West tried to bully this huge country of India, and they rejected it. Huge parts of Africa, large parts of Latin America are also joining the cause. Brazil is the first letter in BRICS. And of course, as I mentioned, the U.S. and much of Europe, still especially Germany, has ideologies connected with the land. I mean, the ultimate evil in both the Soviet and the American mythology was Hitler and a quick, rapidly rising Germany to fight the injustice dumped on it by the Allies. And, you know, Dugin talks about Trump supporters as, but as a radicalized, very large group of people, strongest in the Midwest and the South, who want to end, at least at their very best, want to end the free trade regime. So, Sea Power, liberal democratic, tele-revolutionary, individualist, atomistic, the dominance of the techno-material approach to man as an economic actor mostly. Now, of course, in the postmodern world, the eventual abolition, that is to say, the privatization of the state, the rejection of human nature to the point of the rejection of gender, the abolition of the failure gender itself, and the transition as its ultimate limit, the dominance of artificial intelligence. And the opposite of that is found in Russia and China and other civilizations of the land. The fidelity to tradition, idealism, culture and ethnic culture as a organic entity, spirit over matter, nationalism, cultural diversity, whatever, worldwide, and ultimately, as Dugin says, the salvation of man through Jesus Christ. So to some extent, though, every society on the globe has had to deal with liberal Atlanticism, with the Atlantic powers, so to speak. Putin's been in power now 23 years. And not only do you see this massive revitalization of what used to be a third world country, and the stronger he becomes, the more absurd the propaganda against him becomes. And I talk about psychological projection as a neurotic defense mechanism, because they are constantly accusing Russia or describing Russia in terms that could only be described or ascribed to themselves. Every couple of weeks, some idiot predicts the fall of the collapse of the Russian and Chinese economy. Of course, it never happens. But it can't be a coincidence that their society, whether in England or Germany or the US, is collapsing in front of their eyes. That's the problem with cognitive dissonance. When you believe that history has led up to your ideology, your military organization, and yet the objective facts are at war with that, as you are degenerating into nothingness, the cognitive dissonance creates neurosis. The upshot of all of it is that this special military operation can and is one of the critical pivots by which the world will be, it will be decided if the world will be unipolar or multipolar. This is why the West is so fanatical in its support. They'll jeopardize their own security by sending Patriot anti-missile defenses that it desperately needs. I have a very long paper on the Ukraine war coming out, and one of the things I mention is that there is no real rapid attempt to resupply the West. This has exposed the weakness of the Western for-profit military-industrial complex, which exists all over the world. In Russia, of course, it's in Russia and state-run. Same thing for China. I firmly believe that the USSR was seen by the Western world as a, at least ideologically, more advanced version of itself. You really can't put the USSR into one category or another, because the ideology of Leninism was so artificial and again, imposed by foreigners, by extreme levels of violence, it is hard to fit it into one category. It's like this chimera. It's like Khazaria was at one point. And as much as a regime financed the USSR throughout its entire history, I've spoken of that at great length, but when it became too large, and especially if the Soviet Union threatened to become more of a civilization, a national empire, rather than a Leninist internationalist state, yes, they fought it too. You know, the liberals remained after the Soviets fell, but they were in a very shaky state. The alliance that is not shaky at the moment is the relation between Russia and China, and now India and Iran and several others. If anything is stable, they are. But 30 years ago, this was not obvious. And I want to note the concept of the distributed heartland. Most countries, including the most blatant sea powers, have heartland nationalist forces within them. So Russia embodies this multipolar world order. but it's fighting for all of us, any of us that reject liberalism in all of its forms. The regime will never admit defeat of itself. It may have to couch it in soothing verbiage, but the Ukraine war is largely over. It should have been over in the first couple of weeks. But the ideology of the trading sea powers in its modern variety directly come from Hobbes and then Newton and then Charles Darwin. It's the continuing desacralization, the revolution that rejects everything spiritual, rejects estate hierarchy, rather wants to talk about winner-take-all voting system. It rejects true aristocracy, monarchy. It is vehemently anti-Christian as it pursues material prosperity, whatever that is, as the only real goal. The Renaissance unleashed the ideology of the Gnostic sea powers with its development of usury, which is just another word for capitalism, free trade, as the core of its very being. The regime sees itself, I'm talking about today, as the very embodiment of progress. And the East, generally speaking, land powers, traditional powers, are backwards. And that's it's a slang, backwards and progressive. Liberalism is by definition progressive, while everything else is regressive and hence leads to a backward society. But this liberal modernization, and those are, synonymous, only liberalism underscores Western modernization. They grew up together. Requires colonization in all forms, because the market system, the capitalist system, needs its markets to constantly grow larger. It needs a pool of raw materials and labor expanded indefinitely. And after 1945, the world was divided between two leftist powers, the U.S. and NATO on the one hand, and the Soviet Union on the other, who were allies consistently from there on in. I mean, they both accepted and supported Israel as a state from the Soviets, especially in 1948 onward. This new order, the sea power, uses debt and hence usury as its main weapon, because no country, especially small ones, can engage in the modern regime without going to Western banks, without going into debt and then having the banks through the IMF or whomever restructure not just your economies, but your entire society. The Atlanticist liberal idea is a global one. One of the many things that socialism, Leninism, I should say, Marxism, and modern capitalism have in common. Actually, maybe next week, I'm writing up a comprehensive list of just how similar those ideologies are. Solzhenitsyn, many, many years ago, gave me the idea to do this. But of course, both ideologies are revolutionary and seek to expand themselves abroad. There's no dissent from their sense of their fulfilling the mandate of history. And this is why, for whether it be the Soviet Union or the U.S., the world can only really be liberated if it accepts one of those two modernist ideologies. So since from the Renaissance on, elites in the West, in the big cities, have taken debt and usury and capitalism as the main focus of their development. And if they truly believe that they're on the verge of victory, which of course they're not, the chances of a multipolar order are very slim. But Russia is winning on every possible front here. The sanctions have been, as I said in the beginning, a gift to this alliance. The U.S. is being cut out everywhere. If the SMO is finally victorious, and I hate to even consider the bodies of Orthodox men being thrown, knowing that they're going to their deaths. The Russians don't want this. These soldiers aren't, anti-Moscow. But if Russia wins this, and they will, the course of history is going to radically change. Modern liberalism and the, what really is the triumph of capitalism and usury worldwide. It's a historical zenith. From the foundation, the Gnostics of the Renaissance through Hobbes, etc., up to Darwin, and the current crop of idiots have laid out. The rule of money or the rule of spirit. And Rome is the archetype of the land power. In fact, if Rome hadn't won the Punic Wars, capitalism may well have arrived millennia earlier than it did. But Rome won, as Dugin and many others have said, because of the nature of land society, valor, service, hierarchy, and their religion, which stopped the oligarchy of Carthage, which was, of course, attempting to impose its own order onto the Mediterranean. Their successors from Florence to London have been a bit more successful. Another aspect of the sea liberal power, the regime, free traders, New World Order, is the linear nature of time. This is something else, one of the many things that it shares with Marxism. But it's a fairly recent idea. The Christian point of view is one of degeneration. The old Roman and Greek pagan version is one of degeneration over time, as the genetic errors of generations upon generations begin to combine and greater evils flood the world and tolerated and in fact eventually enforced. But it's one of the products of the Enlightenment. Both Marxism and capitalism see themselves as the final expression, the apogee of the Enlightenment. And really, it's Robert Turgot, who died in 1781, is one of the first moderns to lay out a secular conception of this linear history. And it was only a part of liberal ideology at one point. Now it is liberal ideology. And I'm pretty sure his work in 1750, A Philosophical Review of the Successive Advances of the Human Mind, is one of its early secular expressions, if not the earliest, at least as far as modernity is concerned. That social progress, which means greater atomization and secularization, the rule of free trade, and the suppression of those who don't want that, and that, of course, affects everything. It covers everything from the arts and sciences to all of culture, institutions, law, and whatever. The rejection of a spiritual hierarchy and the imposition of a material hierarchy under a free trade regime, that is the ultimate conception of progress. He wasn't kidding. Now, he thought that the land was the only thing that had value. That was capital to him, being a physiocrat, and only those who own it should be allowed to vote or to hold office. So to translate that to today, only those who own capital should be permitted to rule. And of course, he connects that with a state-controlled education system that would eliminate any intellectual opposition. And it's important to know, at his time, a little bit before, from Hobbes to the French Revolution, those who couldn't keep up, those who lost the Darwinian battle in the market society should be destroyed. And this was the case, the British government during the potato famine in Ireland. Free trade cannot be violated, no matter what happens in Ireland. And if the Irish are too primitive to know what to do, then it's their own fault. And of course, the ideas of Malthus and others that they should simply die off, which is why Turgot had rejected the and wanted the repression of the so-called wheat or the bread riots of 1774. History was the liberation of capital and money. So our modern and now postmodern, I'm not sure you could even call postmodernity a civilization. That's too unitary of a concept for them. But the U.S. is the highest point of this anti-civilization, this anti-culture. And it comes down to the theoretical freedom that each individual, that is to say, individual person with two legs, and that's pretty much about it, is free of any form of collective identity. In fact, that's their definition of what freedom is. He is free from religion, idealism, the ethnic group, the state, the race, property, gender, all this stuff. And then, of course, that will eventually give way to the freedom from his own body and its animation by artificial intelligence and the more arcane elements of futurology. The futurology that there's a moment of singularity, this point where the elite will force everyone to cede, as he says, the initiative of development to artificial intelligence. Of course, always using Darwin as the core idea, as so-called the apes pass that spark to the human species. Now, the human species, at the next stage of evolution, is to hand decision-making over to what they call neural networks. But human beings have to program this and control this, and that means a tiny, largely secret, technocratic elite. Christianity, as I said, sees world history as a degeneration. Well aware that even with the coming of Christ, the church will reach a certain high point, which we would call the Middle Ages, Byzantium, and of course Russia up until the 19th century, and then degeneration will grow and grow, and the arena of true Christianity will get smaller and smaller and more idiosyncratic. But the victory of the church for that millennium in the Middle Ages, exactly the length of time of the Byzantine Empire, for example, after the fall of Rome, will be surrounded by apostasy. The church will always be small, St. John Chrysostom says. And as it gets smaller in the post-Renaissance, post-modern world, great suffering is going to get greater, culminating in the Son of Perdition. This is bound to happen, but the church, however small, is called to stand fast. One of the ideas of the sea power and the technocratic elite is that pain should be avoided at all costs. Well, we have no choice but to accept it, because we're going to be fighting and are fighting under extremely difficult conditions. So what for the liberal modernists is considered progress, for us, it's even worse degeneration. It's a parody and very unstable. The last phase, the progress, the digitalization, the meta-universe, the abolition of the flesh itself, overcoming man, the transfer of all this to artificial intelligence, is direct confirmation of the reign and the rule of Antichrist. Satan cannot create. That's why the Masons have their grand architect. An architect doesn't create, it just arranges things. Artificial intelligence and this post-humanism is directly satanic. This is as close as demons can get to creating something. The tikkun olam, that God improperly ordered the universe, and it's up to us, the vanguard elite, the Jews, whatever, to do it right this time. What is noteworthy, among many other things, is that this spiritual side of things is mentioned and spoken of regularly by Vladimir Putin, certainly the Minister of Foreign Affairs, the Secretary of the Security Council, many, many high-ranking Russian officials at all levels, which you would think they would be removed from any kind of mystic approach to the world. They're speaking about this all the time. And this is consistent with the Orthodox view. You see, because if Russia is in fact the core of the resistance, which globally speaking it is, that means Orthodoxy is too. But Antichrist, as a manifestation of the Talmudic Western civilization, so-called, that is the Antichrist reign. Religion long abandoned by the regime in favor of not just secularism and atheism, but an aggressive and militant version of that. Materialism is assumed in one form or another as an absolute, unquestionable truth. But in the East, that has not happened. 500 years ago, the Western elites, the Gnostics, sought to build a society without God, a society dedicated to power, and power being money. But it's only from 1945 onward, especially from 1990 onward, reached its zenith, which is why after 1990, the regime got so arrogant in imposing its will and shutting down any opposition. What began in the universities as essentially experimental states of mass censorship and surveillance, anti-white hatred, then was expanded to the society as a whole. To hear someone talk about the end of history, which is not as loud as it used to be, but that all of these problems are, of politics and economics are solved through so-called democratic capitalism, which is their thesis, to us, it sounds like Antichrist is here, or in the very early stages of its existence. This war is between sacred tradition, especially in the Orthodox world, and it's not an accident that it's taking place in the Orthodox world, and modernist materialism, whether it be in the form of liberal or Marxist ideology. The two of them are working together anyway. Now in a global context, for the first time ever, that's why it has reached this toxic level of expression. That's why we talk of the end times. The Protestants, of course, are purely on the side of the New World Order, as is the Vatican today. But their constant fake predictions as to the end of the world has now made a mockery of true eschatological theory, the end times. As far as Ukraine is concerned, you've heard me say, and it's pretty much an obvious truth, Kiev is not remotely an independent thing. It's just an abstract space. A space, though, where these two civilizations confront one another. It is not a local conflict. It is not based on territorial claims. It's a war of absolutes. Have any of you figured, if Ukraine wants to take eastern Ukraine and Crimea, what are they going to do with it? They hate the people who live there. The fact that they're using terror tactics against these people, especially Crimea, and the forensic evidence is in, Ukraine was behind the dam explosion. Obviously, it only benefited them. Doesn't make any sense. They've tried this before. They've attacked it back in October. They've hit it several times before. If they're engaging in terrorism, cutting off Crimea's power and water, that's what the attack on the dam is. That's the North Crimea Canal, which they tried to destroy. They want to starve them or whatever. What do they want to do to them when they take over? And why would you engage in terror against them if you want them to welcome you back? Well, the only thing is, and the only reason could be that they're going to destroy them. Russia forestalled a huge invasion of Novorossiya and hence Crimea. That's what the Ukrainian buildup was, which is why the war was launched on February 24th of last year. This is not a war of basic territorial claims. I say it's a war of absolutes because their intent was to wipe out the fringes of Orthodox Slavic civilization in Novorossiya and Crimea. Well, the region, it's just a pretext for this war. The stakes are cosmic. Now, what is Russia's mission? And in the simplest way, the postmodern conception of the Third Rome is to be the restraining force. As you see in the letters of Paul, the ability to block evil, and especially now at this utterly critical juncture of world history. And that's taken the form of this special military operation. It's no accident that, you know, the idiots who control Biden, the bankers in New York, are calling on all other armies to converge against Russia. And it's not the first time Russia has taken on this Judaic usury civilization on its own. In Crimea, it fought and largely won, or at least fought to a standstill, the entirety of Western Europe. These armies are ontological ones, two fundamental ontological foundations of history. And they lay within the territory of Ukraine. You saw a version of this in the former Yugoslavia. The regime in Kiev is completely and utterly dependent on Washington and Brussels and London. It has, like Kosovo, it has zero independence. It's, you know, the cabinet under Zelensky is largely foreign, unknown to the population, and uses terror and police tactics against its own population, which I don't think even now they even pretend to represent. And it goes deeper and deeper into sadism and just this anti-human contempt for even sympathetic citizens. Now, very few people in Ukraine or elsewhere support Kiev. They may be Ukrainian nationalists, but they don't even see Kiev that way. And they're not picking it as the lesser of two evils. You know, if you read my book on Ukrainian nationalism, you'll see why. It's deeper and more sadistic than even basic liberal ideology will say on the surface. Ukrainians are divided along spiritual lines. And yet, both old Russia and old Kiev cut their teeth on being the defenders of Orthodoxy. That's what the battle was with Hungary and Poland. And Galicia was the heart of the Russophilic movement in Ukraine, which was destroyed by Hungary. Of course, Poland wasn't an entity at the time, but at the end of World War I. And of course, with the Soviet takeover, it annihilated what was left of it. The Unions, remember, are only a very small percentage. And have, you know, their Ukrainian nationalism was based and came into existence in the battle against Poland. And to a lesser extent, Turkey, but the battle against Polish Catholicism, including the Union. So how the Union can claim to have any connection whatsoever to Ukrainian nationalism is a joke, but it just shows you how bizarre this all is. It's a demonic, I don't want to say an ironic demonic trick, because that may or may not work. I'm not sure. But it is a demonic twist of hatred that the foundation, the cradle of ancient Russia, has become the arena of this great globally historic war. I don't think it's an accident that it's occurring amongst the two largest Orthodox states. Zelensky, the Jews in Washington, the Jews in Kiev, are closing down hundreds of Orthodox churches. And there's no real rule as to who's going to be next, because everybody has ties with Russia. There's no getting out of it. It's impossible to be totally isolated. So I can't see any reason that any Ukrainian Orthodox man could side with the present government. So it's not just a matter of Russophile versus Russophobe, but it's far more fundamental. Dugin uses the phrase the absolute versus the relative enemy. And the point he makes, and it's worthwhile in this respect, in the Middle Ages and early modern period, say Russia fighting the Poles, or even the crusading orders of Northern Europe, yeah, they were very different in terms of their Christianity. They had two very different sets of traditions and biases. But both were a traditional people. That changed with Napoleon. He revolutionized and then spread that pedestrian and prosaic bourgeois mentality. But prior to that, the war of, say, the Teutonic Knights in Russia, or of Poland and Russia, the Grand Duchy of Lithuania in Russia, even the Islamic world, the old Crimea, these were all traditional societies with similar hierarchies. But that's all changed. These are they were relative enemies. Now it's an absolute enemy, because there is no common ground between the postmodern empire of the West and old Russia. By its very nature, capitalism is revolutionary. Karl Marx was very clear how important free trade was to his own ideology, because the mixing and intermingling of peoples through trade is going to reduce everything to money, not identity. The British and French revolutions were capitalist ones. They were based on usury. This is also the Jewish utopia. Even human nature, under post-humanism, comes under the tikkun olam, or the repair of the world. But as this is happening, this utopia is also disintegrating. Ultimately now, which is why they're moving so quickly, this open-air Masonic initiation, as Michael Hoffman used to say, but it's pretty clear with transgender parades featuring children wearing all kinds of sexual objects, that's the species that we are forced to deal with. I'm not sure how many people actually are attracted to the postmodern world. Really only the most degenerative elements, or the most ignorant elements, that accept this form of Talmudism. Dugin calls it some sort of a senile hallucination of a decaying brain that creates these final dying images. And of course, Russia and the East, Ukraine included, have not degenerated that quickly. And they're making war, as we are in our respective countries, against this level of degeneration. This degeneration isn't popular, so it has to disguise itself. But everything human within the regime has collapsed entirely. It's a mutated version of humanity. Their lazy utopia of unreflection comes down to their obsession with artificial intelligence. But as far as that group are concerned, let me quote Dugin here. When you look at them, they barely speak. Once they have to lie, their little pathetic subhuman trills suddenly become a frenzied symphony that's deafening. It becomes the music of the spheres. This means we're dealing with a very critical, serious phenomenon, the transition of human civilization and the human species to a lower dimension. He calls them infernal landscapes. But that alters the nature of this war. Russia is dealing with a non-human factor, and we all know this, that manifests itself in a radical way. I want to wind up talking about an outgrowth of this war, and that is the recent foreign policy concept developed by the foreign ministry in Moscow, and it came out on the end of March 2023. And I keep meaning to talk about it, and something else, you know, is always coming up. This foreign policy concept is an ideological declaration, although it uses diplomatic language. Putin's, what we call the sovereign path and the Eurasian path, is now enshrined in a critical public policy document. It's, despite the language, it is very clear. It's also very consistent. War has been declared against liberalism as such. The rules that Russia now, how it defines itself over time, is the core of this concept. It's a clear rejection, now enshrined, the foreign ministry in Moscow, against globalism, oligarchy, and everything that implies. The interesting thing is that Russia calls itself a civilization state. It's not a country, it's not a nation. It's an independent civilization with its own identity, not dependent on some external apparatus. Now, there's not a lot new in here, but the fact that it's now an official document developed at the foreign ministry, signed by Putin, it's going to lead to changes in probably all aspects of Russian life. It's the final repudiation of Western liberalism and capitalism. It's pretty clear that the mask that liberalism worn in the 80s and 90s are gone. What was anti-Soviet, so-called anti-Soviet, the neocons, turns out to be anti-Russian. They only became anti-Soviet once the Jews wanted to go to Israel and abandon ship in the late 70s. Suddenly, the neocons become anti-communist. Anyone, in other words, who wants to push for liberalism's unipolar rule is not a friend, but a clear enemy. Let me read of this concept here. Let me read section 10, which is one of the more important here. And this is directly from the foreign policy concept. The crisis of economic globalization is deepening. Current problems, including the energy market and the financial sector, are caused by degradation of many previous development models and instruments. Irresponsible macroeconomic solutions, including uncontrolled emission and accumulation of unsecured debts, illegal unilateral restrictive measures and unfair competition. The abuse by certain states of their dominant position in some spheres intensifies the processes of fragmentation of the global economy and increases disparity in the development of states. New national and trans-border payment systems are becoming widespread. There's a growing interest in new international reserve currencies and prerequisites for diversifying international economic cooperation mechanisms that are all being created. I say that this is the most important. It's a fairly long document. But this paragraph 10, or section 10, recognizes a critical fact. You can't talk about Western liberalism without talking about money. It functions by, it functions through, and identifies itself with money as a measure of all things. Money and value being one and the same. This is why the economic realm is so important, because it's the locus of the regime's power. My early writings on the New World Order, so-called, we call it the Great Reset now. But it was economic at its root. It was about destroying national borders in order to minimize transaction costs, to force wages down to one universal level, and have no racial or ethnic foundation for rebellion against it. International economics is the locus of power. Now, of course, there are other pillars, but on a practical level, that's the point. But now, what's unfolding, whether it be in Eastern Ukraine or Syria, most blatantly in Eastern Ukraine, now has been confronted by a purely coherent ideology. Again, it's very general. It can't be anything other than general. And there's going to be different interpretations, but none of them will be liberal. But the concept of a civilization state, and I'm pretty sure that's the Russian here, it's not one state amongst others. It's what the Third Rome always thought itself to be. It's not a European nation. It's something greater than this. You can't compare a civilization to any other state, but only other civilizations. As you say, it's not just a very large state or a very large country. It has more in common with the ancient empires, and in fact has autonomous units within it and protected. In addition, the concept refers to Russia as a vast, and I want you to focus on that word, vast, large, Eurasian and Euro-Pacific power. In other words, this is a strong, stable, continental state. Now, the term vast isn't used quantitatively. It's a qualitative modifier. In other words, true sovereignty can only be possessed by powers that are vast. A tiny country really can't be truly sovereign. But referring to Euro-Pacific, Eurasian, as part of the Russian identity, brings the geopolitical idea that so many of us have been preaching now into Russian law. It's the opposition to Russia as this one European state, among others. Peter the Great's entire battle was to bring Russia into the filth of modernist European and revolutionary politics. And it led to the Crimean War, and it led to Russia being dragged into every war after that. The old belief was so important philosophically, and I've been saying this for so long, because it led and manifested itself, the new right in Peter the Great, who abandoned, and in fact condemned, the concept of the Third Rome, which is one of the reasons he left Moscow and recreated the capital on Gnostic lines, on the bones, literally on the bones of the Cossacks, who he forced to dig this new floating city, the Gnostic city. The Third Rome didn't see itself as just one country among others, albeit a large country among others. Peter did. Russia became just another European empire that began speaking German and French especially French, at elite levels, and its seminaries were conducted in Latin. There was a time where iconography, the 8-point cross, all this were illegal. It was only the middle of the 19th century where that changed, when the old belief wasn't going anywhere. The old believers preserved what we know as Russian Orthodoxy today. It wasn't meant to be this way. It was a slow westernization. Not to join the Vatican by any means, but the westernization of the society to make it much easier to be a part of at least Central European politics and economics. There's a lot of money there. If you buy my book, Subornosti, on the Old Believers, you get it from Lululemon, you know, a few places. If you go to Lulu, it's there. You could find it there. My books, it's all available on my page here. I go into that in great detail. The concept of a civilization state is a rejection of the Petrine synthesis and the Soviet synthesis. The civilization state is very similar to the concept of the Third Rome. It's a civilization, the manifestation of a true Orthodox, independent, and sovereign church. That's no accident, because that schism continues to affect the Russian mentality. But regardless, the shrinking world of Russian liberals, which, you know, they can never get more than 5% of the vote at any given moment, if their agenda is made clear, now have to deal with the fact that Holy Russia is manifest now in law in the foreign policy concept. This is now enshrined as a part of the official set of documents that are the foundation of their identity today. And we're going to continue this next week. This is just a part one. But thank you, everyone, for listening, and I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.